Very often, the road for America's most famous singers began in the church. Icons like Whitney Houston, Dionne Warwick, and of course the recently deceased Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, were all gospel singers. Aretha's 1972 album, Amazing Grace, is the biggest selling disc of her recording career.
It's a live album in her father's church, and there you have all the elements of being there in a very spontaneous moment.
Listen, Mary. Tell your sister to don't moan.
And you hear her at her most raw and in her element.
That's Andre Chemo Stone Guess, a writer and cultural critic and the former CEO of the August Wilson Center for African American Culture in Pittsburgh. He says gospel sounds a lot different these days. The question is, can it evolve and still maintain a deep connection to the church?
Well, some will argue that all American, indigenous American music, of course, with the exception of that of the Native American, owes its roots to the Negro spiritual and its combination with the Anglo hymn, whether it be jazz, blues, rock and roll, country music, all that root American music. And so out of that tradition, you have gospel music. So it goes from the Negro spiritual, like Wade in the Water, for instance.
Wade in the water, Wade in the water, children, Wade in the water, God's a kind of trouble in the water. See that band all dressed in white, God's a kind of trouble in the water.
Then in the 30s, you had Thomas Dorsey, who some people consider to be the father of what we say is gospel music.
If you can't talk to God, if you can't say something to your neighbor about God, if you can't, don't know God, you need to start over again.
Some people, when they say gospel music, they refer to a particular brand of gospel music, which comes from the African-American church. And then from there, you have it going into more of a popular thing, becoming popular in culture and selling over a million records, like Mahalia Jackson, for instance, in 1948.
And so that was 1948. How has gospel changed from then to right now?
Well, from there you had sort of a reigniting of the spirituals with the Caravans. Like in 1958, they did a rendition of Mary, Don't You Weep.
Listen, Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell your sister Martha not to moan.
Tell Martha not to moan.
And then you had like a change that a lot of people sort of notice and hear now, and it's kind of tied to Aretha Franklin, for instance. Like James Cleveland was one of the first to form a large gospel choir that was backing a rhythm section with the lead vocal. You can hear a version of that on Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace record from 1972. And you can hear that sound also later with someone like Whitney Houston on the soundtrack to The Preacher's Wife.
And are there rules about this sound? I know, for instance, if you were to bring in a drum to a church, would that be acceptable?
In the piece I wrote for The Undefeated, there was sort of this tension between where the music is going and what it has traditionally been. There's been this continuum in the African-American church of a sound that has basically like a blues undertone to it, like a feeling. And many people that I interview sort of are lamenting that sound is being lost. Because there's always been a tension in the church between what's going on in the sacred and the secular. People bringing in certain elements from the secular world into the sacred experience. I look at it on sort of three different axes. There's the spiritual, which is the integrity of the music and the sound, to be rooted in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then there's the cultural element, which is the music and the message sort of painted along a cultural landscape and the sound of a culture or the sound of a people. And then there's a tension that goes along with those that is social and economic. When you go to, let's take recorded gospel music, for instance, when a record company or someone is looking to sell music, they're looking to sell it to an audience. And so what is it that that audience is going to want? What is it that we're going to need to give to them in order to make it maximize its sales?
Okay. Are y'all ready? Turn it up. Snoop. Yeah. Let's go to church life.
So Snoop Dogg seems to be a good example of this tension. He recently came out with a gospel album that was a huge hit.
There's a lot of discussion about what this really means in terms of, like, Dr. Judith McAllister from West Angeles in Los Angeles. She talks about musicians being salt and light, and that the life that you lead should be consistent with the message that you're singing about in the gospel tradition. And so when there is a departure from that, it can take away from the message that you're trying to bring forth. You know, when you're looking at it from a spiritual standpoint, you say to yourself, okay, he's singing this or rapping this message.
Was a time when a storm came in my life. Didn't know which way to turn, to the left or right. Out the corner of my eye, saw a little light flickering like a flame in the darkest night.
It's almost morning.
So how's that juxtaposed against the life that he is leading now? Not necessarily the life that he used to lead.
Okay, so how would you say hip-hop has impacted gospel music?
I think hip-hop has impacted everything. A lot of the musicians in the black church go out and play in the secular world and are music directors for people like Jay-Z and others. And they're bringing back some of the styles and some of the feel from the things that they're playing out in the world. And you talked earlier about these great singers like Aretha Franklin and Whitney Houston. So that has been going on for years. But yes, there are the opportunities economically are much, much greater for many musicians, particularly talented musicians in the secular world than it is in the church or the sacred.
Andre, let's end it there and let's go out on a little bit of Aretha Franklin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andre Kimo Stone Guest is a writer and cultural critic. He was the VP and producer for jazz at Lincoln Center in New York and CEO of the August Wilson Center for African American Culture in Pittsburgh. Did you grow up in a religious community where music was important?
This is Dakota from Tampa, Florida. I grew up in a hardcore Catholic family, school and choir included. Even though I am now lapsed, I still catch myself singing hymns.
This is Brian Jones in Austin, Texas. I grew up in a religious town or family, whatever, but did not really get into the music. Anyway, I'm thankfully listening to a lot of different kinds of music and not stuck onto the same stuff that my high school friends have been listening to since they were in high school. Haven't really ventured out and, you know, listened to a lot of other things.
Hi, my name is Pam Hall. I live in Midland, Michigan. And I answered yes. I was in choir in my church. I took band in school and also piano lessons as a child. I remain active in a choir today, and I still jam with musician friends.
My name is Kate Kinzer. I grew up Jewish and musical, and I spent my childhood and adolescence singing and chanting Hebrew texts, psalms, prayers at home, at synagogue, in the car, at civil rights demonstrations, anywhere. And I've continued that into adulthood and judge all other music by the modalities and memories I have of Ashkenazic Hebrew music.
Mm-hmm. You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.